Professor Glazer, First Amendment class, November 17, 2008,
205. And make my review session geared toward, you know, answering the questions that you guys have brought up. So that should be, you know, pretty straightforward. Okay, but from now until the end of the course, we're going to be mostly talking about the religion clauses. Clearly, since we've spent a number of, you know, class sessions on the speech clauses, you know, there will be parallels that you'll think of. They're not in the same amendment by accident. So despite the fact that, you know, there are two separate sets of words that govern the speech cases and the religion cases, respectively, that doesn't mean that they're totally unrelated, right? So that by way of introduction, we'll talk a little bit about the right not to associate, which is the attendant right to the right to associate. And then we'll move on to talk about the religion clauses and give, you know, kind of a general overview to how the religion clauses are interpreted, how what their history is, that sort of thing, which is the reading from pages 543 to 563. Okay, so with respect to the right of free association or the right to expressive association, I use the terms interchangeably because we're in a First Amendment setting. Right. If you were not in a First Amendment only setting, okay, then you should call the right to expressive association. Why? Because there's another right to intimate association that derives from the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, not the First Amendment. Okay. So I call it free association as shorthand. But I just want to footnote that there is another type of association that's also free, but it's intimate association, and it's different from the association right that we're talking about. Okay, so the one that we're talking about, the First Amendment right to free association, the right to expressive association, takes the position that, you know, if the right to free speech is going to mean anything at all, then it's not possible for that right to be taken in isolation, okay? So, for example, you know, people talk to each other. If the right to free speech is going to mean anything at all, then it's got to protect the way in which people talk to each other, okay? Essentially, you know, the right to free association is the product of a policy decision by the court in the NAACP case, that says, you know, when people exercise their right to free expression, they often do so by way of associating with other people. Okay, so for example, if we're going to protect the right to free expression, then we've also got to protect the right to free association. We've talked about where this comes from, where the right to free association comes from, and it's generally thought to derive from a thought process like the one that I just described. Namely, you know, the speech clause does not mention association specifically, but because speech only matters when it happens among groups of people, therefore, the free speech clause does mean that this right to expressive association is protected. There's a minority view that, you know, the right to free expression, the right to free association, rather, derives from the actual words of the First Amendment. Those words are the right to peaceably assemble. But as I told you before, it's a minority view. The reason I bring it up, even though it's a minority view, is that if you were to look at the words of the First Amendment and you were to say, and I were to ask you, which of those words do you think most directly relates to free association, I bet you would answer the peaceable assembly clause. So that's why I bring it up. But generally, and as we've noted previously, you know, there are limitations to deriving the right to free association from the peaceable assembly clause. Most notably, the fact that association does not often happen through actual assembly, okay, through physical assembly, which is what is meant by the peaceable assembly language. The Facebook experiment, to the extent you want to call it an experiment, the Facebook you know, episode or whatever, when you guys looked at my Facebook profile and answered a number of fairly obvious questions about my stance on this or that, taken from, you know, whatever was on my Facebook page, right? The point, among others, of that little experiment was to suggest that there are ways in which you can derive information about me, and specifically about ways in which I would associate with particular groups that have nothing to do with my standing outside and protesting for them. Right? That's one way. This weekend is a good example of that because of all the, you know, marriage equality protests and things like that. So surely if you were to go into a park and see somebody you knew and you, for example, didn't know what their stance on same-sex marriage was, and you saw them at a no-on-8 rally, right, then you might be able to gather that their stance on marriage conforms with that view, right? They didn't tell you that, but you saw them standing around with a bunch of people whom you can only expect would be like-minded people, right? Another way of gauging somebody's interest is not about, you know, seeing them standing at a rally, but rather from the fact that they told you they were a member of a certain group, or that, you know, there are certain assumptions that you make about them based on, I mean, it could be anything, right? I gave you the option of telling me in that third question, what did you use to base your assumptions on? And I imagine that you noticed that I didn't affiliate specifically with a political, whatever that question is on the Facebook profile that says, you know, what's your political affiliation? I didn't fill that out, but then again, you know, there were lots of other things that, you know, you could derive my political leaning from. One of them that I didn't get from your answers, but that I wanted, I was just interested if any of you would have said this, but none of you did, was just by way of who I'm friends with. Right. So one way, I guess Facebook is a tricky, you know, there's a tricky way of gauging this from Facebook because of the privacy settings and whatever. But one thing that I thought of was, you know, it's possible to understand what somebody's political leanings are, or maybe, you know, make some assumptions about what their views are on specific issues on the basis of who their friends are. You might be wrong. I'm not suggesting that this is a perfect mechanism. But if you're just grasping for straws and you're thinking, you know, what if you didn't know me, right? What if you didn't know, you know, what if we didn't have a semester together and you were just looking at my Facebook profile? If there really wasn't a sufficient amount of information, then, you know, how would you derive any assumptions about, you know, what my stance on X or Y or Z would be? Okay, but the kind of main takeaway of that experiment was to suggest that, you know, even though you have not seen me in a room with a bunch of people who are meeting for a particular reason, even though, you know, I was not peaceably assembled with a particular set of people in a public place, right? So the two examples there are, you know, being a member of a club that actually meets in private or being in a public setting protesting, for example. Even though none of those things were things that you saw, there were still ways of your gauging what my views were on the basis of whom I associated with, right? Even if it was just a click away. Even though I had never met with the NRA, the Boy Scouts, or the transgender equality, or the, you know, people for same-sex marriage, or whatever the other group I joined was. So that's kind of the main takeaway of the Facebook experiment, which tells us that, you know, the right to free expression, or the right to free association, rather, is textured. Okay, so there are, you know, ways of associating that involve meeting at clubs, that involve protesting, but also ways of associating that don't. So this right to free association comes with an attendant right not to associate. Okay, the way that the court first thought of the right not to associate was by way of somewhat of a sleight of hand. The court in the NAACP versus Alabama case basically said, and I'm paraphrasing, that if we are going to have a meaningful right of expressive association, then there also has to be an attendant right not to associate. Now, why would there have to be an attendant right not to associate if there's going to be a meaningful right to expressive association? So let's back up a second. What does the right not to associate mean? Mm-hmm.
It's like an omission. Like, I have no opinion either way. And basically, I'm not aligning myself with any...
Right. Right. So, you know, the way that this came up was through the disclosure of membership lists in the NAACP. Okay, so, and in 1958, that was a pretty big deal to disclose membership in the NAACP. This is pre-1964, pre-civil rights, etc. Okay? And the case, the NAACP case that gave us this right not to associate said that, you know, there's some value in protecting the fact that you don't want to disclose your membership in a particular group. So Beth, you're right. It could mean, the right not to associate could mean, you know, your decision not to make public your alignment with a particular group. It could mean the fact that nobody can make you join a group in the same way that nobody can make you recite, you know, a particular political position that you don't agree with, or even one that you do agree with, right? That there is this right that attends the right to free speech and makes it meaningful. That is the right not to speak, or the right not to associate, okay? So the idea is that, sure, it's great that we have this right to free speech and a right to free association that derives from it, but how meaningful is that right if somebody can make you join a club that you don't agree with or say something that you don't agree with, right? Because that would be, you know, that would undercut the right. That's the idea. Now, so in the context of, you know, the right not to associate cases, we get the right from the NAACP case, which basically, you know, tells us that in this, there was a particular discovery process that required disclosure of membership lists from the NAACP, and the court essentially ruled that the law that said that pursuant to this discovery rule, they had to, the NAACP, had to give over their membership lists, that rule infringed on the First Amendment right of the association, of the NAACP. Okay, so basically the NAACP could not have been made pursuant to this rule, okay, so that statute set up that we always have, could not have been made pursuant to this rule that said they should have to disclose their membership lists, that they didn't have to do that. Okay, because the right infringed on their First Amendment rights, not their First Amendment rights of free speech, but their First Amendment rights to associate. Now, one thing to note, and this is not just about the NAACP case, but rather about the association cases, we're talking about a particular, not a particular person's free speech rights, but a particular group of persons, apostrophe after the S, association rights. Okay? So this is, you know, going back to the diagram that I put on this side of the board, right, when we're talking about free speech, bless, we're talking about, you know, one person maybe saying something inflammatory, right, and how we deal with the statute that person's arrest was based on, for example. Here, we're talking about a group of persons and we're talking about their right to speak. Now, the association doctrine gives us entry to not only associations' rights, but also the rights of prospective members, or members who had been ousted. So what's important to keep track of when you're reading a right to association cases is whether it's the association that wants rights or whether it's the person who wants rights. Now, Dale is a good case where, you know, we've got kind of both sets of interests vying against each other, right? So we've got Dale, the prospective, or I guess he was not a prospective member, he was an ousted Eagle Scout, versus the right of the association. to kick him out. Now, is there a difference if we've got a setup like this, where we've got, you know, a group and their right that's grounded in the First Amendment versus a particular individual and his right that's grounded in the First Amendment? Are there different rights that pertain to the association versus rights that pertain to the individual? So when we're talking about, you know, the expressive association doctrine, and we're talking about the specific rights that it affords as a doctrine, is there a difference between the expressive association doctrine as applied to individuals versus the expressive association doctrine as applied to people, individual, as applied to associations? So the group versus the individual. Well, what can groups do pursuant to the expressive association doctrine?
I was going to say, from like what we've learned from consumer speech, there shouldn't be a difference.
Mm-hmm.
A single person, like the point of the First Amendment, to make sure that that person is not subject to the tyranny of the majority.
Mm-hmm.
So they should have equal footing, but at the same time, I guess you can't force a group to accept the view of the individual, nor can you make the individual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's, I think, a nice starting point. There's nothing in the First Amendment that pertains specifically to individuals versus groups, right? In the text of the First Amendment, we don't see a difference between here's the First Amendment for groups and here's the First Amendment for individuals, right? We don't see that. But practically speaking, the ways in which we can assess the First Amendment rights of groups versus the ways that we can assess the First Amendment rights of individuals are different. Why are they different? Well, because here, you know, we know what Cohen wants to say, right? He wants to say fuck the draft. We understand that he has one position, even though he might change his mind tomorrow morning. When he was arrested, he seemed to be, expressing a particular view. On the basis of that particular view, he was arrested. And what we're here to do, we the court, is to assess whether the statute upon which his arrest was based violated his First Amendment rights to say fuck the draft. Okay? Now, in some ways, that's an easier case because we can be sure that Cohen's opinion is consistent with himself, right? With respect to a group of individuals, what becomes really difficult is assessing the extent to which they each hold particular views. So if you had a fuck the draft association as opposed to just Cohen, right, just Cohen who says fuck the draft, then, you know, it's not clear that every person in the Fuck the Draft Association actually means fuck the draft. Why? Why could it be true that a group of people, the Fuck the Draft Association, meeting in room 205 at Hofstra Law School, which is a public school for the sake of argument, in order to meet the state action requirement, why could we not be sure that everyone in the room means to, you know, to express this view, fuck the draft? Can we be sure? Yeah.
From a practical point, like a person might have feelings against the draft, and that's the only group that's available on campus that's like doing something along those lines.
Yep.
So even though they don't agree with 100% of their tactics, they join the group so that they can promote their own idea.
Mm-hmm.
Non-profanely protest the draft.
Like yeah, that's a great point. Kate.
Oh, just in addition to that, it could be someone who's not really sure about how they feel and going mm-hmm. to get to, you know, their viewpoint.
Totally. Okay, so we've got at this point, Patrick's unfortunately not here, right? So you could be Patrick. Namely, you know, because Patrick indicated in an earlier class that, you know, he would be inclined to join a group, and I think he said he had joined groups with the express purpose of being the dissenter in the room. Right? So you could be Patrick. You could be the dissenter in the room, such that, you know, you really don't think the same thing as the other people in the room. You think, you know, not, right? You think the exact opposite of what everybody in the room thinks. or you could just not be sure, right, as Kate says, or you could be generally interested in draft issues and talking about the draft, and unfortunately, there's not a club available to you that has your exact position. So to bring up same-sex marriage again, this is actually a good topic, I think, for this, because, for example, you know, if there was a gay rights group that was, as a lot of gay rights groups are now, you know, very in favor of same-sex marriage, it used to be the case that there was a stark division in the gay rights movement between those who were in favor of same-sex marriage and those who really thought that same-sex marriage was, that marriage in general was not the answer. Right now, it seems that the gay rights movement has been kind of subsumed with those who hold this view about same-sex marriage. So if I don't believe in marriage, for example, but I believe in gay rights, then the fact that I go to a gay rights club meeting at this public university, so we satisfy the state action requirements, doesn't necessarily mean that I agree with everything they say, because, for example, I, unlike everybody else in the room, don't believe in marriage. I don't think it's the answer. But unfortunately, you know, the way that the gay rights movement has gone on over time is, you know, it's all about same-sex marriage, right? So I would be the person in the room who, you know, I think most like Ruth's comment, wants to talk about and be aligned with people who have similar views, but unfortunately, they're all talking about same-sex marriage, and I think marriage is wrong, hypothetically, okay? So whereas we see eye to eye on some issues, we definitely don't on some other issues, and unfortunately, you know, because associations require people, right, just a mass of people, it would be impossible for me to find a group that, you know, has my exact views, okay, because there just aren't, so the argument goes, there just aren't a group of people who believe in, you know, gay rights and also believe that marriage is not the answer. So I would be a person who, whereas I don't believe the opposite of what everyone in the room thinks, so I wouldn't be, Patrick, we just mentioned you. This is you. So I wouldn't be Patrick, but I would be, you know, somebody who doesn't believe in a fundamental, you know, tenet of this group. Okay, so why? So we encounter these sorts of problems in the context of association because, you know, the fact that, you know, I am going to have the exact same opinion as everybody else in the room it seems somewhat unlikely. Did you have a comment or no? Yeah. No. Okay. You seemed engaged in a good way. So I was just, you know. And unlike other people who seem engaged in the way that you did, you don't have a computer in front of you, which is why I thought that maybe something was actually funny as opposed to a particular window being funny. So in any event, you know, the fact that I'm going to agree with 100% of the views of 100% of the people in a particular room that I joined a club in order to be in seems unlikely, just based on percentages. If that's true, then we've got a particular problem with respect to expressive association doctrine that we don't have with respect to regular free speech doctrine, right? Cohen is going to agree, at least for that moment in time, with 100% of his own views, whereas the idea that any one of these people is going to be in complete agreement with each other at any point in time is highly unlikely, no matter how seemingly aligned the interests of those in the rooms are, Okay. But in order to approximate a free speech doctrine that can apply to groups, the court has come up with this idea of the unified message, right? And you can see that it might make sense for the court to do this, because otherwise, how is the court going to get a sense of what this group is meeting for, right? If the only way is to interview everybody in the room and get their thoughts, you know, read their Facebook profiles and answer a questionnaire about what it is that you think they believe, that doesn't seem efficient. That doesn't even seem like it would produce any accurate results with respect to why these people are meeting in one particular room at 3 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. Might not show up on their Facebook profile. So that seems to be, you know, the reason for getting this message part of the doctrine, incorporating the message into the doctrine that determines whether an association has or doesn't have rights. So just to put on the board, you know, the expressive association doctrine with respect to groups and with respect to individuals. With respect to groups, we've got, you know, a series of questions that were higher up on the board for those of you who are visual learners before about, you know, is the association expressive? Okay, the answer to this question, remember, dependent on what? How do you know if the association is expressive? Yeah. Do they have a message? And then, Meredith, what was the addendum question that you provided for us last time? Okay. So it was A.5, I think. Or then I changed it to A, lowercase a, or something like that. Is there a sufficient nexus between the message and the group? Okay? So I'll come back to this in a sec. And then just to finish out the test, so once you understand whether the association is expressive, you understand that by way of whether they have a message and whether there's a nexus between the message and whatever the group does, and then you figure out, is the message exclusive? And I'll elaborate on what I mean by that in a second. Okay, so once we understand that there is a message, and I think it's useful to focus on the Boy Scouts case here, so this just says, is the association expressive? Message. Nexus between message and group? Question mark. And then, is the message exclusive? Okay. So the Boy Scout case, bless you, is instructive in this regard because there we have, you know, a really clear case of the court trying to find a message. We might not agree that the message was, you know, as prominent as the court seems to think it was in the purpose of the Boy Scouts Association, but for the moment, let's just assume that they were right for the purpose of understanding the doctrine. Okay, so in the Boy Scouts case, the court essentially looked through the Boy Scouts manual, found wording about the fact that the Boy Scouts value morally clean, upstanding citizen types, and, you know, made the determination that there was a sufficient nexus, that the connection between that message that, you know, they value morally clean, upstanding citizen types, and whatever it is that the Boy Scouts do on a day-to-day basis, and once they decided that, they then turned to the question of whether allowing or disallowing James Dale to continue to be a member of the Boy Scouts would have conflicted with this message. Okay, so when I say in B over here, is the message exclusive, I mean, does the message conflict with admitting a particular individual? Okay, now, the reason that I think that's a fair way to characterize the doctrine is that the rights that groups enjoy pursuant to the expressive association doctrine are the rights to control membership lists. Okay? That's what their rights are as an association. Because the way in which associations speak is by having members in their midst, okay? So the issues tend to come up when particular members or prospective members, like James Dale, conflict with the message that is the reason that a particular association is expressive, right? The association wouldn't be expressive if not for having a message. Of course that's true. The message is what makes the association expressive. The court then determines that there's a sufficient connection between whatever their message is and whatever the association does. Now, we can have a debate about whether, in fact, the court was right to decide that the nexus was sufficiently there, but they did determine that they thought it was, okay? And then once they determine that, then there's sufficient expressive grounding upon which making the association take James Dale as a member would have been compelled speech, okay? So once the A inquiries determine that the message is, that the association rather is expressive, admitting a particular member amounts to compelled speech, according to the court. Okay, so just like, you know, it would be bad for the state to say you have to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, arguably, right? If you don't believe it. So, too, it would be bad for the state to say you, as an association, which we treat similar to a single speaker in the context of the expressive association doctrine, you, as an association, have to admit this person, which essentially is you have to speak through this person, right? Similar to whether to if the state were to say, you know, that you have to say a particular prayer, that you have to say a particular sentence, whatever it is. So the rights that groups enjoy are the rights to control their membership lists, assuming that they meet, you know, these requirements. The rights that individual members enjoy are what? What do individual members of an association have the right to do or not to do as a result of the expressive association doctrine? It's a harder question, yeah. Perfect. Right not to disclose membership. Now you might say, well, they have the right to disclose their membership too. And I would actually say that, sure, anybody can disclose their membership, but cases are only going to come up if the state is trying to make you disclose membership that you don't want to disclose. So the fact that you can disclose your membership is not actually a First Amendment right, because there's no negative freedom there. The state wouldn't be imposing anything on you. But your right to keep your membership to yourself would come up in a First Amendment context, because we can imagine, for example, a statute that says, you know, we need the following information from you, we the IRS, let's say, right? We need to know what your club affiliations are. I don't really know why the IRS would need this, but let's say like the Census Bureau, right? The Census Bureau, you know, requires some information from you. You don't want to give it to them. That's the type of case that we're talking about. So you as a member, you don't have the right to enter into any association you want to, right? But you do have the right not to disclose the ones that you do enter into, okay? All right, so those are the main points that I want to highlight with respect to expressive association and the attendant right not to associate. The attendant right not to associate generally comes up when individuals don't want to disclose their membership, or when groups don't want to divulge their membership lists. The right to associate comes up when associations, the groups, want to exclude particular members. So they have this affirmative right to exclude somebody like James Dale, provided that the court finds that James Dale's identity, essentially, is in conflict with the purpose, the message of that association. Okay, yeah?
Can you just repeat the last part? The right to associate comes up when either like individuals or groups are trying to consult, like, if the groups are trying to control the memberships and individuals don't want to disclose their membership. And the right not to associate comes up when groups are trying to exclude other people.
No, the right not to associate would be this, the right not to disclose, okay? Or, in the NAACP case, if an association doesn't want to divulge its membership list to the state, right, then that's the right not to associate. And then the control of membership lists on the part of the group would be the positive right to associate. Patrick and then Adam.
Has the court given any guidance on what constitutes a sufficient nexus for the purposes of messaging or making nexus?
Not explicitly, no. I mean, you know, the way that you would find it is through Boy Scouts. So, no. I mean, I write in this area, so I definitely know that there's nothing. Yeah?
When you say the right not to have a membership disclosure, is that the right of the group not to disclose your membership?
Either. That would go both ways. So the group has the right to be the bouncer at the door, right? And also the right not to disclose. The individual has no bouncer rights, but does have non-disclosure rights.
Is one, I want to say, stronger, but is one given more weight and force than the other?
It's just different. So the reason I went through this exercise was just to explain that while there's nothing in the First Amendment that explicitly differentiates between groups and individuals, the practical way that this ends up cashing out is inherently different for groups versus individuals. So whereas, you know, it seems like groups have more rights pursuant to the expressive association doctrine, that's not really true. It's just that the times that this doctrine would be invoked by an individual are fewer, and there would be, like, less texture to what those rights would be than with respect to groups. But it's not a stronger or weaker thing. It's just kind of a how it comes up thing. Okay. Why don't we take our 10 now and then come back and talk about religion? Welcome. Do you have a number? Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Basically, it's like there are people who don't show up here that show up in New York, but it's like
right. Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fast.
Right. No, and I've told the owner that there's some, you know, accident.
Okay.
But
let's go.
Let's one. Okay, that's fine.
Hey.
Yeah.
So the difference between like Dale and
right.
Is it because they're already members? I feel like they're trying to promote, like I guess, like Medicaid is doing their, participation and such. So like, excluding women in these positions, I feel like further their purpose more so than
right.
in Dale.
Right.
But is it just because they were members already?
No, I mean, I would be part of the process to find that. And there's a lot of literature about the fact that they actually are. So, you know, the cynical but probably true answer is that there was more of an incentive as part of the Dale Board to find the Boy Scouts than there was in the broader but it's the type of thing that if you're faced with the next case, you would be well to say, and to say, right? Like, new cases that say X, new cases that say not X.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
But in her way.
She's very, very quirky. I ran into her when I ran into her last week. So it's hard to tell on her.
Okay, so now we're leaving speech and we're moving on to religion. Now, the religion clauses, there are two of them. One is the free exercise clause. The other is the establishment clause. So as you see in, you know, the beginning pages of this section on page 545, the First Amendment bars Congress from making laws respecting an establishment of religion, so that's the establishment clause, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, that's the free exercise clause. And doctrinally, they're separate, okay? So when you think about the speech clause, there's only one of them. There can be a lot of things that we've got to say about, you know, just those few words, but there is only one speech clause. With respect to the religion clauses, there are two of them, and they have separate and distinct rules that govern them. So that's just an important point to note. So if you are answering a question on an exam, in another setting, whatever, that pertains to the religion clauses, just be mindful of which religion clause you're dealing with. It could be both, but just remember that you've got to apply different rules to the different clauses. But we're going to hold off for a day on, you know, the particular rules that govern the particular religion clauses, and we'll talk today about, you know, the history of the religion clauses and an overview of what sorts of questions are going to come up as courts deal with the religion clauses in the aggregate, both of them. So we've got this one. The first case that comes up is the Everson versus Board of Education case, which is a New Jersey case that came before the Supreme Court in 1947. The reason that this case starts us off is because of the way that the court in that case talked about the history of how it is that we're supposed to interpret the religion clauses. And just to set us up, there's a pretty big debate, and here's what it is, with respect to the religion clauses. One side of the debate says that what we're trying to do, what the religion clauses are aimed to do, is in order to separate church and state in a meaningful way, right? The other side says that the religion clauses are meant in order for people to be able to choose actively which religion they want to believe in. Now, is that a difference? Do those two positions have to be inconsistent with each other? That on the one hand, the religion clauses are meant in order to separate church from state, in order to provide distance between the secular state and the, you know, non-secular religious populace, versus the other side of the religion clauses debate, which says, well, you know, the state doesn't have any involvement in whatever religion you choose, but we're supposed to encourage people to choose whatever religion they want. Yeah?
I think it's, what about people who don't have any particular religion? Like, I think on the first option, mm-hmm. they don't have more protections than people on the second.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And again, we're talking in broad strokes right now, so we're not talking, you know, specific applications. But I think you're right that if we are to view this debate through the lens of the person, the individual person who does not believe that he or she has a religious affiliation, then these two polarized sides of the debate seem to conflict. The one being, you know, the religion clauses are a way to separate church from state. The other side being, you know, the religion clauses are a way for each individual to express him or herself religiously. And that's the protection that the religion clauses offer. So that's definitely through that person's eyes, there is a conflict between these two positions. But it's not, I don't think that the two positions are in conflict through everyone's eyes, right? Because, for example, if you are, you know, it's certainly possible that you could think that the purpose of the religion clauses is to separate church from state, in that you don't want the state to have any involvement in your choice of which religion you want to believe in. So from the view of a religious person, it would not be, you know, necessary to say that these two polarized sides of the debate conflict with one another. But I think it's important to see that they are polarized sides of the debate, that through someone's eyes they do conflict, but not through everyone's eyes do they conflict. Okay, and, you know, we're not going to come down on one side or another of this debate, right? So through, when we're done with our class, when we're done talking about the religion clauses, you know, you might have formulated an opinion on the basis of reading certain cases about what the religion clauses were intended to do, but that doesn't mean that, you know, it's a definitive opinion, right? We're not going to say, okay, this is the right way to think of the religion clauses, that is the wrong way to think of them. But I do want to you know, just expose you to the idea that there are these two ways of thinking about them. Yeah?
I don't really understand why a religious person wouldn't see them as being polar opposites.
Tell me.
I just don't understand your reasoning behind that, because I would think that they would still see it as one side takes, like, a separation of the other side says, I'm not going to tell you which one to pick, and I don't see how you can...
Well, because the other side, right, the I'm not going to tell you which one to pick, doesn't say that you have to pick one, right? It just says that if you do pick one, we're not going to get in your way, right? So it's certainly possible that a religious person would not have to see them conflicting, but there could be cases in which they would conflict.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. No. I just mean to suggest that, like, it's presented as a very polarized debate in the book, in literature about the religion clauses, but it doesn't have to be so polarized through everyone's eyes. That was my other point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I was just saying. Mm-hmm. Personally, I don't know this person.
Yeah.
I don't think you meant as.
I don't mean as a rule. Yeah, I just mean that there could be people, right, religious people, secularist people, who don't see the seemingly polarized sides of a debate that has been characterized as polarized as though they conflict. There could be somebody who does see them as conflicting, but I just want to point out that they don't always conflict in everyone's eyes, which is a useful point when you read cases where the judges dissent on this basis, right, on the basis of how they sort of see the overall tenor of the religion clauses. But if you understand that those two positions don't necessarily conflict, then it just it could cause you to question why this justice dissented from that justice. So that's the payoff in understanding that the polarized debate doesn't have to be as polarized. So as you can imagine, you know, there is this more general constitutional debate about, you know, original intent, original application, textualism. I imagine that these are pretty familiar terms to you all. And again, I'm not here to present, you know, my view or anybody else's particular view on whether, you know, we should care about the Constitution from one perspective, a textualist or an originalist perspective, or another perspective. But the religion clauses are rife with, notes of originalism. So whatever you think of originalism, if you want to investigate it further, the religion clause cases are a good place to start. Because the way in which the religion clause cases came about was certainly, as a matter of history, through persecution that was exacted upon certain groups. And so there is this idea that, you know, they should be free in order to believe in a particular religion, not that they should be free from religion. Okay, so that's, you know, a shorthand way of understanding the polarized debate. Freedom to engage in religion would be the second, you know, the second position that I enunciated. The, you know, you can be free to choose whatever religion you want, versus freedom from religion is the separation of church and state. You know, the state should be a secularist institution that has absolutely no religious affiliation. So historically speaking, there is a sense, bless you, that that the religion clauses, you know, certainly came about through religious persecution, and if they came about through religious persecution, then that might suggest that, you know, there should be a more religious bent to the religion clauses, that this is not about preserving a secularist state. And those of you who take seriously an originalist conception of the Constitution might also take seriously this idea that, you know, if that was the atmosphere through which the religion clauses were enacted in 1791, then, you know, they should be preserved with that intent. There are reasons to argue against originalism more generally, not only with respect to the religion clauses, but, for example, you know, a couple of classic arguments against originalism are that, one, you know, how are we really to know the intent of the framers? I imagine that one is a particularly familiar one. A less familiar one, but an argument against originalism nonetheless, was that no matter what you understand to be the intent of the framers certainly was not to have an originalist conception of the Constitution, right? So even if the intent of the framers was to, you know, preserve religion, for example, or, you know, to only protect certain things that would classify a speech and not other things that would classify a speech, or to protect only certain groups and not other groups, if you're talking about equal protection, then what we don't know, and even an originalist would have to admit that we don't know, is whether the framers intended for their intentions to govern from now until the end of time. Right, so even if you think we should be preserving their intent was probably not to have their intent preserved. Right, it's a slightly more complicated, but yet another argument against originalism more generally. So again, you know, that doesn't have to do only with the religion clauses, but I think because the religion clauses touch on, you know, a more broad debate about, you know, the effectiveness of originalism versus other constitutional interpretation mechanisms, I think it's important to just kind of get out there some of the prevailing views for and against originalism. Okay, with respect to the religion clauses, particularly the Everson versus Board of Education case gives us a nice, you know, pretty flowery flowery, pretty flowery monologue, essentially, about, you know, the reason for the religion clauses. So just to quote a little bit from the bottom of page 545 through page 546, a large proportion of the early settlers of this country came here from Europe to escape the bondage of laws which compelled them to support and attend government-favored churches. The centuries immediately before and contemporaneous with the colonization of America had been filled with turmoil, civil strife, and persecutions generated in large part by established sects determined to maintain their absolute political and religious supremacy. With the power of government supporting them at various times and places, Catholics had persecuted Protestants, Protestants had persecuted Catholics, Protestant sects had persecuted other Protestant sects, Catholics of one shade of belief had persecuted Catholics of another shade of belief, and all of these had from time to time persecuted the Jews. In efforts to force loyalty to whatever group happened to be on top, and in league with the government of a particular time and place, men and women had been fined, cast in jail, cruelly tortured, and killed. So Beth, your comments earlier, even though it pertains to the free speech clause, does pertain here too, right? So we see automatically parallels between the speech clause and the religion clauses as a general aggregate group, in that there is a sense, historically speaking, that the reason that these two ideas, religion and speech, appear in the same amendment might be because both clauses are aimed at not at preserving the rights of the minority in the face of a, you know, tyrannical majority, right? So here we see, as we did in the speech context, that, you know, there was a group that had a particular point of view. It happened to be religious in the context of the religion clauses, right? And in the context of the speech clauses, it could be whatever. But a majority point of view, and there was a dissenting minority that needed to be heard, and the purpose of the First Amendment, collectively speaking, was in order to preserve the rights of the minority in the face of this majority that was kind of overtaking them, right? Through speech, because of their viewpoints, ideas, more generally speaking, through religion, because of the way in which they believed. Now, so we see, you know, we see a link between the free speech clause and the religion clauses in the idea of, you know, preserving the rights of a dissenting minority. We also see that, you know, historically speaking, at least according to, you know, this brief excerpt, seem that the religion clauses emanated from an environment in which there were established religions, that essentially the state and church were aligned, right, in such a way that, and the notes bear this out a bit more, that, you know, taxes would have been collected in order to be paid to particular churches, that sort of thing, right? Things that we would not imagine could go on right now, because setting aside, you know, however you interpret the religion clauses, there is an overarching goal of the separation of church and state that is a constitutional principle, even if it's not, even if it doesn't bear out in a particular clause, right? So, so we do have a separation of church and state now that makes a historical situation like this seem totally foreign to us, right? But that doesn't mean that the religion clauses in 1791 didn't emanate from an environment in which there were established churches that people were forced to pray at or whatever. Yeah?
I'm just confused. So do you mean that even though we understand the clauses to mean that, you know, separation of church and state
mm-hmm.
should be kept, but that you might not necessarily mean what the Constitution was about?
No, I mean that however you interpret the religion clauses, if you interpret them as freedom of religion or freedom from religion, a situation of the type described in the passage that I just read would not happen, whether it's because the religion clauses themselves bear out a separation from church and state, or whether other constitutional principles from other parts of the Constitution bear that concept out, okay? We have it no matter how you think of the religion clauses now, right? There's a reason that even though you might think that the religion clauses are a freedom of religion and not freedom from religion interpretation, right, that this would not happen. That we would not have a situation where there are established, you know, state actors that are churches. We don't have that, whether it's because of the religion clauses or because of something else. That's all I meant. Okay, so what of this idea that historically speaking, you know, we did have these established religions, they were beating up on other religions, and so we're kind of getting rid of this bullying, essentially, by way of the religion clauses. Do you think that even if that's true as a matter of history, that that should govern how we interpret the religion clauses?
I don't think that we should be stuck to what the Constitution might have meant at that time.
Okay.
I think it should be more about what society needs today, because I think the perception that we have today of religion might not be the same that they had, you know, back in 1789 or whatever.
Okay. Other thoughts? Yeah, Nathan.
You sort of watered down the timing of what it was meant to. And in terms of originalism, if you're looking at the history of the period, neutrality means that probably you don't need to fear.
Right.
Whether proactively or negatively.
This
allows people to practice or not practice that religion.
Okay. So the comment being, you know, if I'm just equating this case with another instance in which originalism shouldn't matter, that's saying too much, because really there's something very specific about, you know, the severity of the problem that ended up causing the religion clauses to be enacted. Bless you. Yeah?
I mean, what could you even argue that at the time they were trying to present, like, speech through religion or vice versa? Now it's almost like society has become so polarized, religious-wise, that it's actually, restricting speech, because it's so protected now that it's actually, restricting the speech of other people.
That's an interesting point, and it does bear out in the literature, because, you know, whereas, and I think it's a nice response to Nathan, I think you'd probably agree, that whereas there are certainly a lot of people who are religious now, there are definitely fewer people who are very religious than there were in 1791, right? So if that's true, and if now, other viewpoints have taken the role that religion had taken on in a previous generation, then maybe having a special exception for religion is outdated in itself. I imagine you have a response to that, but I just want to, I think it's a nice retort. Yeah?
I'm in favor of the original intent, mainly because the framers saw how horrible people can act towards each other when religion comes. So they created this way of, saying, here's your state's religion, here's your state's religion, and our government is going to govern this way. And whether or not they're going to say separate or protectionist, either way, you're not having people, prosecute each other.
Right. No, I got you. So that's also a nice comment to contribute to this conversation, which is, well, sure, Rosa may have a point that empirically speaking, those who would have in another era been religious have now replaced whatever their religion is with some, belief that doesn't really conform to what we would ordinarily define as religion, right? But they do believe in something. Okay, and there is a case, it's on one of the later pages here. Let me find it for you. On page 561, in note 2, there's a United States, the case is United States versus Seeger, where Seeger stated on a draft form that he preferred to leave the question as to his belief in a supreme being open, and that he had a belief in and devotion to goodness and virtue for their own sakes, and a religious faith in a purely ethical creed without belief in God except in the remotest sense. Okay, so there we have, you know, an idea. I recognize that this is a bit of a tangent, but I promise I'll get us back there. The court unanimously found that Seeger qualified for the statutory exemption. The test was whether a given belief that's sincere and meaningful occupies a place in life of its possessor parallel to that filled by the orthodox belief in God of one who clearly qualifies for the exemption. So here the idea is, well, sure, we have an idea of what religion means, and that idea probably, you know, requires a temple or a church or things, you know, a pastor or a rabbi or something along those lines, but there's no reason to essentialize religion in that way, says the court in Seeger, not says I. So, you know, there are certainly beliefs that people have that might look like, you know, and share characteristics with what we would ordinarily call religious belief, but they, you know, might be possessed by somebody who says explicitly, as this guy did, you know, that I don't have a God, I just have a concept of something that's ideal. You know, so sort of a God in a Kantian sense as opposed to an actual God. I don't go to church, I don't go to temple, I don't do the things that you might associate with being religious, but nevertheless, that's what I believe in. And in, you know, 1967, the court was ready to say that that's fine, right? You might disagree with that, but that, I think, bears out Rose's point, which is, you know, well, today, right, 1967 even, it might be the case that people are less religious in the traditional sense than we would have interpreted them to be in 1791 or years following 1791 or years prior to 1791. But that doesn't mean that they don't hold strong beliefs in something because of which, you know, they might be scorned, right? Beth says, well, sure, but that doesn't mean that they are going to be persecuted in the way that's particular to the way that the history previous to the enactment of the First Amendment articulated, right? So having fights over land on the basis of religion is something that only real religion, right, can generate, one might argue. Right, and even though this guy Seeger and maybe some friends of yours who might identify as atheists might say that, you know, they believe in something, they believe in kind of basic tenets of morality, be good to your neighbor, etc. But that doesn't mean that those are the sorts of beliefs that are going to generate the type of persecution that the First Amendment was enacted to protect groups from. Ruth, you had your hand. Right, and you know, there's certainly, I mean, I think that any time the court, you know, provides some historical backing, there's going to be a gutsy. Right.
The second thing, probably more important thing I wanted to say, was that different groups throughout history who have, like, preached for, like, non-interference with religion, non-coercion religion, like, Anabaptists is a big group that was really into the separation of church and state in an early day, that's like the Amish and the Mennonites. They were just as persecuted for saying, we don't want to tell you what to do, as anyone who said, we do want to tell you what to do, and it's different. So to say that, like, that the negative coercion is not a source of persecution, is also, like, not true. Lots of people who just want to stay out of your business have been persecuted for trying to stay out of your business.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, Quakers also super big.
Right. So, I want to note but not quibble with your point about the history, just because, you know, sure, I mean, I would say that, you know, historians can stay in business because there are differing ways to interpret history, right? So the fact that the court is citing one way, but really it was another way, it's not something that I can, you know, assess on my own, and And whether or not they're right, it doesn't take away from the fact that that's still precedent, right? So, so they could be totally wrong, but unfortunately we have Stare Decisis, which to some degree would only breach the holding, but, you know, really would probably, I mean, if you were to cite Everson in order to say something about the history of the religion clauses, even if you weren't citing the holding of Everson, that would still be something close to binding, right? Whether or not the history is accurate. So for that reason, I think that it's a fair point, historically speaking, but one that I don't think will bear on the doctrine just because of the broad way that we've used Stare Decisis. With respect to your second point, namely that, you know, even if you take the view that freedom, that the religion clauses are a freedom from religion clause, that they are freedom from religion clauses as opposed to freedom of religion clauses, that shouldn't then color the way that you view the originalism point, because even those who are secularists have been persecuted, right? Even those who think, you know, I'm not saying anything about, you know, imposing my views on anybody else, those people have been persecuted as well, which I think is an important historical point to note, and is another reason that the polarized debate is not so polarized. So with respect to this case, you know, we have, you know, the Everson case to tell us that the general theme of the religion clauses taken together is one where there is division between those who think, you know, this is a matter of persecution, it's a matter of, you know, the freedom of religion, and those who think that this is a freedom from religion amendment with respect to religion. Okay. So then, you know, we've got a section here that talks about the history of the religion clauses in more detail. I am going to skip over in our discussion that, you know, going through those notes in depth, just because they do bear out the discussion that we've already been having, which is just, you know, these are kind of the ways that the religion clauses are viewed, and I want to talk about the general approaches to the religion clauses, which begins on page 554. And we've got, I think, seven different ways to talk about, or eight rather, different ways to approach the religion clauses. And I want to go through those just because I know from various sources that note material in books has a wide range of acceptance among students. So if there is note material that I want you to really focus on, then, you know, I want to tell you exactly how to focus on it. Okay, so general approaches to the religion clauses. So we first got this strict separation approach. We'll count here. Okay, so the strict separation approach. So we have this idea that the clauses could be read, says the book, to erect an absolute barrier to formal interdependence of religion and the state. Religious institutions could receive no aid, whatever, direct or indirect, from the state, nor could the state adjust its secular programs to alleviate burdens the programs place on believers. Now, this bears out differently, as the quote suggests, from the Everson case with respect to the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. I want to hold off on that discussion to you know, the next couple of days when we talk about those clauses as separate from each other. But for now, the idea is, if you take the religion clauses to mean that there is a true separation of church and state, then really the import of the religion clauses would be in order to have this absolute barrier between church and state, right? So whereas a general constitutional principle might say that there should be this separation, right? Not the religion clauses, but just generally constitution, taking out the First Amendment would suggest that. But here we have an absolute barrier that's kind of sealed by way of the religion clauses. And this is one way of approaching them, such that religious institutions could not receive money from the state, whether it's the state actually taxing people in order to then give money over to a church, or whether there's some sort of incentive for religious institutions that the state provides. So, for example, a tax break, if you are a religious institution, would qualify as something that would be objectionable if you are a strict separationist. Okay? So that's one way of interpreting these clauses. Then we have a strict... neutrality construction, where we have this quote, religion may not be used as a basis for classification for purposes of governmental action, whether that action be the conferring of rights or privileges or the imposition of duties or obligations. Okay, so states then have to use only secular, inherently not religious criteria in order to act. Okay? So strict neutrality as a way of approaching the religion clauses doesn't allow the accommodation of secular programs to religious belief. Okay? And the quote goes on, it does not permit aid to religious institutions that satisfy the purely secular criteria for participation in the program, at least if the courts are unwilling to conclude that the criteria were not concealed methods of using religion as a basis for the program. Okay? So here this is it's not so different from a strict separation. It's just a further preservation of secularism in the context of the state, right? So there, you know, you would not even be able to use religion as a factor. That's the difference between a strict neutrality position and a strict separation position. So here... religion can't even factor into state decisions. Here, you can think of this as no money to religious institutions, just as a shorthand way of describing the differences between these positions. So the next way that, yeah?
I'm going to give a tax break to every single establishment on Street F.
Uh-huh.
And the second one, you could do that. And the first one, if you're a religious institution, you wouldn't be able to do that.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a helpful example. Okay, so the third approach would be the non-coercion and anti-indoctrination, where we have basically this idea that the state can't encourage you as a citizen to be religious, right? So for example, we have, the established clause prohibits only aid which has as its motive or substantial effect the imposition of religious belief or practice. More broadly, the religion clauses prohibit the government from influencing religious choice. Okay, so here we have a move away from the secularist approaches that collectively one and two are, right? They have their differences, but they're both secularist approaches towards this non-coercion or anti-indoctrination approach. Non-coercion, anti-indoctrination. Where here, there's an assumption that you are going to pick a religion. Of course, you don't have to. Right? But there's an assumption that people are going to pick a religion, and the purpose of the religion clauses, according to this third approach to them, is that the government shouldn't influence your choice to pick one religion over another religion. Okay, so government stays out of your religious choice. Okay. And I'm going through these quickly because I want to kind of get them all out on the table here. Non-preferentialism. Is a fourth approach, so there the government can't favor one religion over another, nor can the government disfavor any particular religious view, but it can support religion in general.
Okay, so again, these are not so different from each other. The non-coercion, the non-coercion of the anti-indoctrination versus non-preferentialism. Here, the government can't favor one religion over another or over no religion at all. And again, each of these approaches that I'm putting up on the board is a particular approach to the religion clauses. Okay, so this is assuming that they say what they say, and this is a way that, you know, scholars in particular and courts that have then adopted in some way, in some measure, the views of those scholars would see the religion clauses, the way that, you know, courts and scholars would approach the religion clauses. So to take these in tandem, because they are similar to each other, the anti-indoctrination says, you know, you're going to have a religious, a choice among religions just based on being a citizen in this environment, and the government stays out of that choice, right? The non-preferentialism takes it one step further and says that the government can't favor a particular religion over a particular other religion or over no religion at all. So the positions are similar, much like, you know, strict separation and the strict neutrality positions are similar. It's just that, you know, the non-preferentialism says that, you know, the government can't favor a particular religion. So this is similar to, you know, no viewpoint discrimination, right? The government can't pick one viewpoint over another. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, when it said that you can't disfavor any religious view, including an anti-religious view, mm-hmm. it can support religion.
Right.
How can it fail to disfavor an anti-religious view when it supports religion?
Well, I think the idea is this, that whereas the first two approaches say that the state can't have any dealings with religion. Right? That's, I think, what that last little clause is meant to address. But basically, according to this view, as opposed to the first two, the state can support religion, right? They can say, you know, they can give money to religions in general, but they can't do that to one particular religion over another. That would be an approach. That would be the difference. So, I mean, that's setting aside, of course, general church-state separation. But if you just view these as approaches to the religion clauses in general, I think that'll make some sense. Tell me more.
I just don't understand how you can both support the anti-religion viewpoint while supporting religion. It seems totally contradictory. I don't really think that including anti-religious views can possibly be true. Like, how do you give equal support to people who object to religion when you're allowed to support religion? Like, who is that person? How are you going to give equal support to them? I can't, like, even imagine a fact scenario where that would be possible.
I mean, I'm failing to see what the conflict is, because to my mind, it's certainly possible that you can have religious people and anti-religious people coexisting. Right, and this particular approach to the religion clauses says, we're not saying that the religion clauses prevent the government from engaging with religion at all, as, for example, the first two approaches would, right? So we're saying that's totally fine, but, you know, the government in supporting religion can't say that that one religion is better than another, or that
government support religion while equally supporting anti-religion. I mean, I don't mean to be mathematical about it.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, you know, coming from a First Amendment stance, you know, it would seem that the government is essentially providing kind of the effect of a public sphere, right, where, or public forum, where, you know, the views of the religious are supported, the views of the anti-religious are also supported. That's, I think, what this, I mean, I know that non-preferentialism is generally captured out to mean that. So now I think I understand your frustration, which is if the government can support religion, and that's essentially saying, that they support a particular viewpoint, right? If religion is pitted against anti-religion, right? That's your point, right? Non-preferentialism, I think, is opening more doors than it's closing. So here's, I think, the way that the architecture of this approach seems to work. It says, we're not saying that the government has to stay out of religion at all, like a strict neutralist would, or like a strict separationist would, right? We're saying it's totally fine for the government to support religion. So we're not saying that there has to be this, like, mega divide between church and state, as some people interpret the religion clauses to mean, okay? But if the government is going to do that, it can't be viewpoint discriminatory. Now, you might say it's inherently viewpoint discriminatory if the government is going to support religion and then support anti-religious views. I think it's more just kind of offering a public forum for differing viewpoints, but not creating the absolute barrier between the state and religion that the strict separationist or the strict neutralist would. Okay? I understand your frustration. I understand that it's a mathematical, logical frustration. And that's how this approach cashes out, though. Okay, I saw some hands. Were they in response to this discussion, or...
Mm-hmm. Partially on religious, historical treatment, and then they right. also on the social business community. If it falls under non-preferentialism, you give all religious institutions tax exemptions, and then you also get tax exemptions for, say, like non-profit organizations or tax free salaries and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Would that fall under the same line? Supporting religion in general as an interest would be?
Well, but I think Ruthie's point still stands, which is that if you were to do that, right? But then the anti-religion nonprofit applies for 501c3 status to get a tax break, then if there is a preference for religion, presumably they wouldn't fall under it. Now, if what you're saying provides that an anti-religious organization would fall into the other category, along with, the environmentalists and who else, whatever, the people against abortion, the people for abortion, whatever it is, then it seems that would be a nice mechanism to capture the anti-religious and the religious, as long as they have some, kind of purpose that you define to be somewhat open. But you, the IRS, are not preferring Catholics to Jews or Protestants to Catholics. You're also not preferring Protestants, Jews, and Catholics to anti-religious people, so long as the anti-religious people go through the appropriate hoops that the environmentalists would have to. That's your solution, which I think works. Though it is, I mean, it does present some confusion, which I think is a valuable point to linger on for a sec. Yeah.
So non-preferentialism allows such a situation as mm-hmm. was just described, but doesn't require. The anti-religious organization
right.
could be denied 501c3 status and not be lumped with the a-religious organizations
mm-hmm.
if the government so desired under a non-preferentialism approach.
No, because according to the non-preferentialist approach, as it's laid out in the book, an anti-religious view would be equal to any religious view, which is the reason for Ruth's confusion. Yeah.
The way I read it, when I think of anti-religion or non-religion, religion, just speech or non-speech,
right.
grouped in one.
Which is I think that's exactly right. Which is why the anti-religious perspective is included in the description of non-preferentialism, but that still doesn't take care of your concern. I think you're absolutely right. That that's exactly how the non-preferentialists think of anti-religion. They're like, it's not different from religion. It's just the same way that people who are for abortion or people who are against abortion are all talking about abortion, right? And we've been conditioned through the speech clause to think about the difference between subject matter and viewpoint. And if we're thinking about things that way, religious people and anti-religious people are all talking about religion. They're either for or against it. And I think that's exactly right. It's an it's an export of the speech framework into the religion framework to say that anti-religious and religious views are both equally viewed by the state, and that's fine, right? And it would not surprise me if I have never seen a paper specifically about importing the viewpoint neutrality framework to the religion clauses, but I suspect that a non-preferentialist would have to or would do well to justify her position by reference to that, because essentially what you're saying is, you know, the way to think about it would be 1 and 2 provide that the government has no business dealing with the subject matter of religion, right, whereas 3 and 4 are basically saying the subject matter engagement of the government with religion is fine, but if that subject matter engagement then turns into viewpoint discrimination, that's when things start to get ugly, right? That's when the religion clauses kick in. And that would be a speech-ish understanding of the religion clauses. So that's, I think, a nice way to think of it. Did somebody else have a hand? Yeah, Adam. It would be the former, but only because that's how any constitutional protection works, right? So it's always that you're preventing the state from doing something. That's just always the architecture of con law. Okay, so moving on to the fifth way that people approach the religion clauses, we have this voluntarism. And separatism. Viewpoint or approach on page 557. Here, you know, we have Larry Tribe arguing that the religion clauses rest on a pair of fundamental principles, voluntarism and separatism. And he says, voluntarism means that the free exercise clause was at the very least designed to guarantee freedom of conscience by preventing any degree of compulsion in matters of belief. It prohibited not only direct compulsion, but also any indirect coercion, which might result from subtle discrimination. So viewed, the free exercise clause as a mandate of religious voluntarism. The establishment clause can be understood as designed in part to assure that the advancement of a church would come only from the voluntary support of its followers and not from the political support of the state. So, you know, here this is just similar to the non-coercion or the anti-indoctrination, right, that the voluntarism provides that the state can't directly or indirectly incentivize membership in a particular religious organization. And with respect to separatism, there is this institutional separation of church and state. It means that the state should not become involved in religious affairs or derive its claim to authority from religious sources, etc. Okay, so here we see a melding or an effort to meld some of the earlier perspectives or the earlier approaches. So here, I would say that the voluntarism and separatism is a meshing of, you know, three, very much three, to some extent four, plus 2 and 1. So to the extent that there are similarities with these two, and then with these two, number 5 is the aggregate of these two, 3 and 4, and also these two, which is not so weird in the context of scholarship, right? Because you can imagine, you know, law professors have to make a living, they need to write about something, they can't be preempted, so it's not surprising. I mean that sort of facetiously, but it's not surprising that there would be kind of a view that would at the same time hold
what these people say and what those people say, right? So whereas you might have thought that there was no way to reconcile these people and those people, along comes Larry Tribe to do so. You had a point. Oh, okay. I'll give them back later. Okay, so in any event, that seems to be what the voluntarism and separatism approach allows for, essentially, you know, that you don't have to think of the religion clauses as only secular or only non-preferentialist. You can think of them as both. Okay, the sixth way of approaching the religion clauses is what the book calls equal liberty, which has two principles. And this comes from a 2007 article by Chris Eisgruber and Larry Sager. In the name of equality, no one ought to be devalued on account of the spiritual foundations of their importance, commitments, and projects. So aside from the attention to discrimination and hostility and neglect, religion shouldn't be treated as deserving special benefits or as subject to special disabilities. They offer a broad understanding of general constitutional liberties, like free speech, like free association, and they contend that those rights, as opposed to the special religion clause rights, that those other rights in the First Amendment will allow religious practice to flourish. So here, this is the idea that if what Rosa says is true, right? If what Rosa says is true, and by that I mean, if it's true that we as a whole, as a populace, are less religious than we once were, right? Not that individual people have less religious faith, but that overall there are fewer religious people than there were at one time, and moreover, that what has replaced religion in our collective lives is holding some sort of belief in a very strong way, right? Such that we then become this dissenting minority, right, in a way that the First Amendment should protect us. According to the equal liberty approach to the religion clauses, there shouldn't be anything special about religion, because anything that would have been special about religion at a particular point in time has been captured by the interpretation that the court has given to the speech and association clauses. Okay? So there is a paper by Brian Leiter, and I don't remember the name of it, but it's like, what's so special about religion? It's called something like that, and it might be not special, but what's different about religion, or something along those lines. And this is the type of approach that the equal liberty approach in the book is meant to characterize. That basically, you know, whatever rights we think were important for religious groups have effectively been subsumed into the other clauses of the First Amendment, so we can still take seriously the separation of church and state, because we just have to treat religion as though it's another viewpoint. And if we treat religion as though it's another viewpoint, then the speech clause and the association right that's derived from the speech clause would protect any dissenting minority, whether or not that dissenting minority is religious. So for equal liberty, I'm just going to put, you know, religion and non-religion are afforded equal rights, and then those equal rights effectively would be no viewpoint discrimination. Okay? So the state can't favor one religion over another, but there's no reason that that has anything to do with the fact that it's a religion. We already know that if you hold a particular viewpoint, right? So if you just substitute in religion for viewpoint, or viewpoint for religion, the rights are going to cash out to be the same. Michael? Historically, yeah. But, yeah, exactly. That's their exact point, which is, you know, if people hold particular views the way that people once held religious views, then there's no reason that, you know, we should treat them any differently now. Yeah.
The argument of fact that time and
no.
Sorry to cut you off, but you're saying they would not have a reconstructionist view of the history, necessarily. They would just say that history doesn't really matter because those rights are still protected. But the reason that they take the view that they do is that they take seriously the separation of church and state. Right? So if you take seriously the separation of church and state, then there's an incentive to find rights for religious people in a non-religious based clause.
Just as a catch-22, that phrase isn't in the Constitution, it's in the letter.
What phrase?
Separation of church and state.
Right.
Why do you keep that specific?
There's some idea that, you know, there are overarching constitutional principles that might, you know, that don't appear in particular parts of the Constitution, but that are, you know, just as important, if not more important, than the words themselves. So that's the idea. Whether or not you buy it,
might
totally
not,
separate.
In other words, should not be hypocritical, and they would say that it's not because it was written at that time.
No. Yeah. No. It has. There. It would be a necessarily non-originalist view. Yeah. Okay, we're out of time. We'll do 7 and 8 at the beginning of next class, and we'll go on to talk about the Establishment Clause. See you Wednesday.